So let's look at what will work for ADD-ADHD, but actually that takes us into epilepsy. These are just astounding studies. Found them quite by accident, just Googling around. Isn't that nice? That's a verb now. To Google. Would you conjugate that verb for me, please? All right. Okay. Effect of the ketogenic diet on the activity level of attorneys. Children, adolescents, and adults with epilepsy often also show symptoms associated with ADHD. The ketogenic diet, which is administered to children, watch this, administered to children with epilepsy refractory to drug therapy. Stop. What did they just say? Yeah, well, after we've exhausted all the drugs, well, then we'll try this diet thing. Just makes me nuts. Seem to improve in individuals with symptoms of ADHD. What they're admitting is, well, the drugs didn't work, but then we changed their diet, and that seems to work. So one would ask, could you reverse this then? Why don't you start with diet and perhaps don't need the drugs? Well, that's not standard of care, you see, and there's not a lot of literature on that. I thought that's what I was reading here. All righty. This behavioral change may relate to the improved behavior seen when children with symptoms of ADHD are placed on the diet. So epilepsy linked with ADHD, I view them all as part of a continuum, just putting the needle down a different spot on a bad record. This one is mind-blowing. Epilepsy news. Ketogenic diet prevents seizures. Although the high-fat, calorie-restricted ketogenic diet, KD, for the rest of the article, and again, these are on your CD, has long been used to prevent childhood epileptic seizures. Wait a minute. Has long been used? What class do you recall learning about that in school? It's long been used, and you learned about it in what class? You did not, nor does any medical practitioner. Long been used by who? Satan and his spawn? Who's doing this?
Probably Russians.
No, not the Russians. Johns Hopkins and Stanford and 17 other teaching hospitals. But nobody knows about it. Has long been used to prevent childhood epileptic seizures that are unresponsive to drugs. Physicians have not really understood exactly why the diet works. But they were using it nonetheless. Now, new studies by a research team at Emory University School of Medicine show, watch this, that the diet alters genes. Let me do that again. Diet alters genes. One more time. Diet alters genes. Take this gene and shove it, not expressing you no more. It's a new version of an old song. You like that, huh? Diet alters genes involved in energy metabolism in the brain, which in turn helps stabilize the function of morons exposed to the challenges of epileptic seizures. Diet alters genes. Now, I gave you a website earlier today, brucelipton.com. That's the whole field of epigenetics. It's not about the gene. It's about the environment of the cell. And when we alter the environment of the cell, we can alter which genes are expressed, which ones are turned on and off. Now, that's not orthodoxy, but that is cutting-edge stuff. Emory University didn't know what to do with this, so they simply published, and they caused a firestorm. Why wasn't this on the evening news? Why wasn't this, one of the guys with the little health news talking about the incredible potential for diet to alter genetic expression? I would think that'd be a hot item. And if I were king, but I would not be on the air. These findings support our hypothesis that a dietary regimen can dramatically affect the expression of genes and the function of neurons within the brain, which enhances the ability of these neurons to withstand the metabolic challenges of epileptic seizures. The diet causes ketone bodies to be produced as fat is broken down, and scientists have understood that these molecules somehow cause a change in metabolism, leading to a potent anticonvulsant effect. According to some animal studies, they may also, the ketones may also limit the progression of epilepsy. This has been known for almost 100 years. They found, as had others, that in rats fed the ketogenic diet, the resistance to seizures develops slowly over 1 to 2 weeks. Because longer treatment with the ketogenic diet was necessary to increase the resistance to seizures, they concluded that changes in gene expression might hold the key to the diet's anticonvulsant effect. In other words, it takes time. We alter the environment, the body begins to turn off bad genes, turn on good ones, because it's been given an instruction to do so. And that doesn't happen overnight. It takes 2 to 4 weeks minimum is what it looks like. They've even identified where it is. They focused on the hippocampus, a region of the brain known to play an important role in many kinds of epilepsies. The most striking finding was the coordinated upregulation of genes involved in energy metabolism. They found that the ketogenic diet significantly increased the number of mitochondria per unit area in the hippocampus. This finding, along with the concerted increase in the expression of genes encoding energy metabolic enzymes, led them to conclude that the ketogenic diet treatment enhances energy production in the hippocampus and may lead to improved neuronal stability. In other words, in the ADD-ADHD epileptic case, that area of the brain does not process glucose very well. It's energy starved. Going on a ketogenic diet as a hybrid switches fuel systems, turns on different genes, and it hums like a Mazda. They were blown away. They said, for the first time, we think we know why this is happening. This is what this body's looking for, a direction to use a different fuel. They found that synaptic communication in ketogenic diet-fed rats was more resistant to low glucose levels than in control animals fed a regular diet. Hypoglycemia is one of the triggers that sets off the epileptic. This heals that portion of the brain so that that trigger wouldn't be there. So it seems, watch this, they took it further, they were actually engaged in thinking. And because the diet enhances the brain's ability to withstand metabolic challenges, they also believe the ketogenic diet should be studied as a possible treatment for Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Many of you know I've talked about this for years, exactly that thing. I was so excited to see this study because now they're just validating what seemed obvious intuitively. You would have assumed the same thing. If it stabilizes seizures, it's got to be good for any neurodegenerative disease. Well, I promise you, your naysaying, ignorant boob colleagues don't know about this study. Please shove it down their throats with great joy. Now, if you're part of that study, it's complex and hard to do. So I was scouting around with cross-references from the studies, and here's what they said. Medical News Today, Epilepsy News, December last year. Modified Atkins diet effectively treats childhood seizures. 2/3 of the children benefited, and it's easier to do. See, the Johns Hopkins and Stanford program is complex. You have to weigh and measure because it's part of an ongoing study. Compliance is not real good because it's a real pain for the family. And what they found was if they just go home and do a modified Atkins diet, just a tad more liberal, they do just fine. A modified version of a popular low-carb diet is nearly as effective at controlling seizures as the highly restrictive pain-in-the-butt Johns Hopkins Center's diet because it's part of a study. Watch. Children who remain seizure-free for 2 years on the ketogenic diet often can go back to eating the crap they usually eat without the return of seizures. Why? Healed the brain. I showed you why. If that's right, if the Emory study is right, that brain has healed. Now, is it good for them to go back to eating the way they did? No, because a brain that healed can unheal. And I would tell them, look, you're lucky. Don't do this. You keep eating the way that healed it. Why would you stop it? Here's a disgusting fact. While the ketogenic diet has proven effective in controlling pediatric epilepsy since its introduction in 1921, and you learned about it in which class? Yeah, mine. Do you know where it was introduced? R.M. Wilder at the Mayo Clinic, 1921. R.M. Wilder knew that throughout human history, the therapeutic tool most effective for controlling epilepsy, or what was thought to be epilepsy, actually thought to be demon possession, was fasting. This kind cometh not out but by prayer and fasting. And they knew that for the epileptic, which in the Greek was the lunatic, fasting helped minimize that activity. So yes, there was a spiritual component undoubtedly, but there was a physiologic component, and fasting is what stabilized that. Wilder looked at that and said, it appears that all cultures have done the same thing. They knew that fasting would help. They didn't understand why biochemically, but he said, we can extend the fasting state by cutting carbohydrates. Enough biochemistry was known then. And so at the Mayo Clinic, they began. All right, how many remember seeing the movie First Do No Harm? You have to watch this movie. You must write this down and get this movie. Meryl Streep is the star. First Do No Harm. First Do No Harm. Watch.
That should be mandatory.
That should be mandatory, absolutely, Doc. I think it's required watching. And if I were king, you'd watch it tonight. Get the movie. They probably have one copy at Blockbuster. Get it at Netflix or just buy it. You're going to want your patients to see it. You will want to loan it out and let patients see it. It's the story of a little boy named Charlie who suddenly one day was falling prey to 70 grand mal seizures. Parents had no idea. You probably saw it and didn't know it. It wasn't the kid was great. They showed it on TV twice. It'd probably never be on again. Sponsors didn't like it. Charlie was medicated into being a vegetable, remedicated into being a raving lunatic, and finally they determined what Charlie's problem was. Charlie had too much brain. Yep, Charlie's problem is there's too much brain in there. We need to get in there and do a little brainectomy. And they were about to carve away Charlie's brain, hoping for the best, that he would not be in just a vegetative state. But at least the seizures would stop. Is this bizarre or what? They end up kidnapping Charlie, and he's on so many meds they have to have a traveling nurse and physician go with him. They take him to Johns Hopkins. They heard about the program. They get him there. Before they're going to cut up my baby, we're going to try one last thing. They get him to Johns Hopkins. Meryl Streep is the mother, only to be told, and it's almost a funny scene, I'm sorry, you don't have an appointment. There's something about a she-bear with a wounded cub that eliminates the need for an appointment. Perhaps it was the Uzi that she pulled out. All I know is next scene, he's under care, right? And they're missing a nurse or two. I'm not sure if they found the body parts, but nevertheless, Charlie's in the program. When you watch the movie, make sure that you watch the credits. The best part are the credits at the end. There's a tendency to just turn it off. Watch the credits roll by. Nearly everybody in the movie was a former member of that program. And here's what was mysterious 10 years ago when the movie came out. They would say, so-and-so, only in the program for a month left and has never had another seizure. So-and-so was only there 2 weeks, went back and started and blah, blah, blah. Why? The brain healed. 1 to 2 weeks for some is all it takes to reverse that aberrant gene expression. Now the risk is they may go back where they were. So incredible information, and use these tools to beat these patients into submission. So this is what I'd use. I tell them, look, that's not the answer for your babies. That is not the answer. Here's an answer. Oh, but that's so hard. What's he gonna eat? Okay, where's the real problem in this case? Yeah, have you ever felt like just shooting the parents? There are times when I have felt truly like just saying, you know what, if I had a laser death ray, bzz, bzz, Johnny, you're coming home with us. I mean, sometimes your heart just goes out. Sometimes I look at the kid and I say, man, you get an A. I don't know if I'd do as well as you're doing living with them. The problem is the parents. All righty. Now, let me take you deep inside the mitochondria so you can understand how and why this is so normal and natural. Now, these diagrams come from Thomas Devlin's textbook of biochemistry. If you want to get a good biochem textbook, this is it. 6th edition, textbook of biochemistry. I know you were just hoping to get a textbook list today. Look, she's writing vigorously. Textbook of biochemistry with clinical correlations. That's the who cares part, because the rest of it's really boring. So there's all this Leninger type stuff. It's, oh, gag me, please. And then the clinical part is who cares in practice. Thomas Devlin, he does the best job of explaining this. The phases here relate to the phases here. Now, this is a starvation study. Nobody has done studies on a ketogenic diet because they don't have to. The same thing happens. So in the test animals, time zero was the last meal. Okay, time zero, their last whatever they're eating. All right, and they're in phase one here. They're living on This is glucose used per hour over time. Glucose used per hour, phase one, is all from the last meal. So if you quit eating carbohydrates, which is the same, it's analogous to quit eating everything but water, then for about 4 or 5 hours, all of the blood glucose is a function of that last meal. All right? You're in phase one. Origin of blood sugar, all exogenous from your last Twinkie that you sucked slowly because you knew that was it. Tissues using glucose, all. Why? Because there's lots of it. It's everywhere. It's blowing out your ears. Major fuel of the brain, glucose. Why? Because it's there. All right. Now, as that exogenous source drops, long about 4 hours, it varies a little bit, but your blood sugar will begin to drop, and a tad before, when it gets down to a certain level, variable with each of us here, the liver will begin to release stored glycogen. You've got 2 days' worth of blood sugar stored up. That tells you that we didn't always have carbs available. That's the only reason for 2 days of carbohydrate storage, because sometimes it just wasn't there. So as blood sugar drops to a certain level, I'll begin to release the stored glycogen. Now, what happens in the individual long about this time where the stored glycogen is being released? That would be at about 3 hours. What happens? What are they feeling?
I have issues. I have a headache. I'm weak. I've got cold sweats. I've got leprosy. I need some
sugar. Sugar, thank you. Yeah, food, yeah, right. What kind of food? They need a fix, absolutely. They need a fix and they pump it back up. This is where patients fail. I'll mention going on a ketogenic diet and patients will say, I can't do that. I tried that. How long? Oh, I went several minutes. I went all morning one day and got so weak. And then my real nutritional consultant, my neighbor, told me how bad this diet is. My neighbor, who's my upline sponsor, informed me how dangerous this is. All right. So I begin to release stored glycogen. Now watch what's happening here. All the glucose was from the last meal. Now notice, as that ends, I begin gluconeogenesis. The liver's doing dual duty. As blood sugar drops, I got 2 days worth of emergency reserve. Why? Because in time past, how many meals would I get 100 years ago? One? Would it be carbs? No, maybe it was all the fish I caught or whatever I shot. No carbohydrates at all. So I've got 2 days worth stored to maintain glucose supply to the brain. Because by then I'm usually going to find some berries or vegetables or whatever carbs I eat, all real food, by the way, nothing like what we do. All right? So now I begin to undergo gluconeogenesis. Now I'm in phase two. Origin of blood glucose, well, glycogen being released by the liver, and then the beginning of hepatic gluconeogenesis. And what am I converting into glucose? Fat, dietary and stored fat. I can do that slick as a whistle. That's easy. Now here's what ignorant naysayers will say. Well, you know, at this point, the body starts burning up, tearing down lean muscle tissue. Are you just insane, stupid, or both? That is not possible. Why on God's green earth would your body attack muscle tissue when you're eating protein and fat? Your body says, whoa, there's a good burger, but you know, I'd rather eat up that bicep. Because I'm just really pissed off at this guy. Wouldn't give me my Krispy Kreme donuts. I'm going to eat his hamstrings. That's what I'm going for today. It's just insane. The body never goes to lean muscle mass unless it is starved and there's nothing left. Everybody forgets these are starvation studies. All right, so here we are. In phase two, I'm releasing stored glycogen, which is what I'm supposed to do, and I'm beginning to ramp up gluconeogenesis. The body's asking me a question at this point. It's saying, dude, is it really winter? Are we ready to do this? I'm going to take a few days to get there because in time past, once this started, it continued. All right? But the body's ready to swing back. I might find some berries or I get a little honey today and the body says, okay, all right, we'll store up some glycogen and we'll hit this again next week. Now, at about 2 days, the stored glycogen is gone. At that point, gluconeogenesis hits its peak. They cross over. And the body says, okay, cool, humming like a Mazda now. It's winter time. Exogenous carbohydrate is not going to happen. Got it, dude. We're switching fuel systems. It's that time of year. So now gluconeogenesis stabilizes blood glucose, and it just hums like a Mazda. Why? Because I'm making it. I'm making all the glucose I need. So here I'm in phase three. Let's go to phase three. Blood glucose in phase three, still liver gluconeogenesis, but notice most of it now from what the liver's making. The reserve glycogen is on the bottom because I'm exhausting that. I've just flip-flopped. Tissues using glucose, liver's not, it's making it. And muscle and adipose tissue begin to drop their usage because they're switching fuel systems. They've got the signal. Winter's coming. The brain all the way through is still burning glucose. But now in phase four, after day three, really at about day four and out, gluconeogenesis, liver and kidney. The kidney kicks in here and starts actually making glucose. Did you learn that in school? I didn't. I never knew that the kidneys are involved in producing glucose. We are such an incredibly efficient system when we let it get the signals. Now look what happens. Major fuel of the brain, glucose and keto acids. The brain says, got it, wintertime, switching over. I'm a hybrid. I can do this nicely. At this point, do you know what cancer cells begin to say? Dude, you're killing me. I can't use anything but glucose. Now, after about 3 weeks, the system is fully switched. Gluconeogenesis, liver and kidney, rock solid. Nothing changes blood sugar. Brain switches now to burning 80% keto acids and 20% glucose. It's at this level. It's somewhere in here. Think previous studies. What happened? What happened in that brain? It healed. We increased hippocampal mitochondria. We altered the expression of genes. This is just amazing. This makes me want to scream every time.